But the gospel of God, the good news of Easter, says Kings X. In God's royal purpose for this world, love like that never loses. It alone has life and gives life in a cross-shaped world.
That's the Reverend Dr. James A. Wharton. And today, he brings you a message all the way from 1972 entitled Kings X. I'm Katie Givens-Keim. Welcome to episode 4193 of Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. Welcome to another edition of Day One Classics, where we journey back through our rich 80-year archive to bring you timeless sermons that continue to inspire and challenge us today. In this episode, we are featuring a sermon by the late Reverend Dr. James A. Wharton. Joining us today is someone for whom longtime Day One listeners need no introduction, our resident Day One rock star, Reverend Dr. Thomas G. Long, who will help us unpack Reverend Dr. James A. Wharton's lasting impact and why his sermon still speaks loud and clear today. Born in 1927 in the Belgian Congo to Presbyterian missionaries, Dr. Wharton received degrees from the University of Texas, Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary, and the University of Basel in Switzerland. He served as professor of Old Testament at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary from 1956 until 1975, then as senior pastor of Memorial Drive Presbyterian Church in Houston until 1985, and then served as professor of homiletics at Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University in Dallas until his retirement in 1996. Tom, so wonderful to have you back here on Day One for our Day One Classics episode.
It's great to be back, Katie. Thank you.
So we have a really great one in front of us today. We are going to be transported back to 1972. Tell us a little bit about Dr. James A. Wharton.
Jim Wharton was a well-known Old Testament professor, and he had as the goal of his teaching to let people know that the God of the Old Testament is the same loving and kind God as the God of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. He was always bothered by people who thought about the angry, warfare-mongering Old Testament deity, and he wanted to correct that impression always. He taught at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary, and then because he was such a fine preacher, as we know from our program today, he was called to be the pastor of Memorial Drive Presbyterian Church in Houston.
Big church.
Yep.
Back then too, right?
That's right. And he stayed there until he retired, but then he quickly unretired because Perkins Theological Seminary, noting what a fine preacher he was, called him to be professor of preaching, and he was there for several years.
And did I see he studied under Karl Barth himself in Switzerland?
He did. He did. And he got the both the substantive side of Barth and the playful side of Barth. He had a lot of merriment in the way he preached and taught.
Do you think he would have identified himself as a Barthian, like I am a Barthian theologian?
Yeah, I don't know how doctrinaire about that he would have been, but he certainly caught the spirit, the allegiance to Scripture. And the sermon we have today shows the notion of God as all, and our allegiance belongs to the true and living God and not to the false gods. That was clearly a theme of Barth's.
Well, in thinking about the moment in time when this sermon was broadcast, it's interesting to notice that it looks like, so it was broadcast on November 5th, and then 2 days later is when President Nixon won re-election in a landslide victory. So maybe there was, at the moment this went over the airways, there was some tension or some holding of the national breath do you think?
I do think so. And although it's expressed in theological and biblical language in the preaching that he does, when he was calling for allegiance to the living God, it was also inviting us to have some scrutiny about nationalism and to think about what calls forth our deepest allegiance when we belong to the God of Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And on the international stage, earlier that year, Bloody Sunday had happened in Derry, Northern Ireland. And also, I mean, maybe most important in talking about allegiance in the national conversation was that the Vietnam War was continuing with significant events just about to come, like the downing of the B-52 bomber. So, and the Watergate scandal had broken earlier in the year. I mean, it was a tense time. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. Although in the homiletical world, it was the preaching world, it was a time of story preaching. And we get a little bit of that flavor in our sermon today as well, the good storyteller that Jim Wharton was. I remember one time he talked about an experience he had in junior high. They had a French teacher who was a object of mockery by all the students because she was a large and awkward woman and spoke with an exaggerated French accent. And they called her Fifi. I don't know what her real name was, but they mocked her by calling her Fifi. And one day in class, she told the students that she had been to France over the summer and she had seen the most beautiful thing, Mont Blanc, but she pronounced it Mont Blanc. Oh, children, Mont Blanc. And she showed slides from her trip. And the last one, the ultimate one, was of Mont Blanc. But how she had somehow stepped in front of the cameraman when he took that picture.
No.
And so there was Fifi in all of her awkwardness with Mont Blanc postage size in the corner of the screen. And the students fell out of the chairs laughing at her. And as an adult, he wrote, "I wish I could go back and tell her how sorry I am. She must have cried herself to sleep that night. And now I am a preacher, and I try to get people to see beautiful things, but I keep getting in the way. And my prayer is that the gospel would fill the screen, not me." I think that's the spirit of his preaching.
I'm so glad you tell that story because it gives us an awfully good guess at how he would hope we would hear this sermon today.
That's right. In the clutter that was the 70s, we have clutter today. And what he wants to do is to clear the screen and let us hear the powerful promises of the gospel.
Gosh. And isn't that what, at our best moments, every preacher hopes for?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, we're always tripping over ourselves and getting in our own way, and he tries to clear the clutter out.
Yeah, I love that. Well, and speaking of the clutter that we can bring to help us really hear this text, I wonder if it might be helpful to just note, like when we, because we're about to hear the name Israel many times, we'll hear it in the text, but we'll really hear it in the sermon. Give us a framing for that for modern ears.
Yeah. Israel was the people of God. They were the descendants of Abraham, whom God had chosen and loved. And Abraham was promised that he would be the father of many, many children. And so all of the people of God today could be claiming the name Israel, not just the political entity in the Middle East.
Now, listen for God's word as we hear from the book of Hosea, chapter 11, verses 1 through 9.
When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and offering incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was to them like those who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and fed them. They shall return to the land of Egypt, and Assyria shall be their king, because they've refused to return to me. The sword rages in their cities. It consumes their oracle priest and devours because of their schemes. My people are bent on turning away from me. To the Most High they call, but he does not raise them up at all. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim. For I am God and no mortal, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath.
Now, Reverend Dr. James A. Wharton's sermon, originally broadcast on the Protestant Hour on November 5th, 1972, entitled King's X.
I can still remember the magic of some magical words I learned as a boy. King's X. In our games, as I remember, it meant instant protection. It meant the rules were set aside, at least for the moment, so that some onrushing fate of the game was not allowed to gobble you up. I've often wished it still worked in my experience of life the way it used to work in our games. If life is a game, it's played by a pretty tough set of rules. There are all sorts of onrushing fates threatening to gobble us up, and we would dearly love to be able to say, King's X, the rules don't count in my case. You can't catch me, at least not now. King's X had a lot to do with the way I used to think about kings in general. What a marvelous being a king must be to have an X, whatever that was, some superb power to say, the rules now cease to apply. A power so great that a mere child could get the same effect just by mentioning the words. Am I mistaken, or do I hear God himself saying, King's X, in the 11th chapter of Hosea? The rules of the game going on in this text are fairly clear. God is like a father, and the part of his dearly beloved son is played by Israel. It's God's responsibility to free the child from hurt and danger, which he does for Israel by setting them free from Egypt. It's Israel's part to hear God calling, to answer him as a loving child might answer, by shaping all of life in response to the father's love. But now we hear that Israel breaks the rule. Instead of answering love with love, the more the father calls, the further and faster Israel runs away. Of course, this is no game. What's at stake is the dead serious reality of Israel's rejection of the very love of God. No one who takes seriously the God of the Bible, whether Christian or Jew, can take that lightly. Nothing less is at stake in this game than the very shape and purpose of human life. Whether life is to be lived out as a joyous echo of love and gratitude to God, or whether it's to be lived out in the greedy and deadly attempt to find some other way. Hosea accuses Israel of trying to find that other way by worshiping the Baals. Essentially, for Israel, I believe that meant worshiping the gross national product, the gods of production. And I don't find that to be nearly so long ago and far away a piece of idolatry as one could wish. People still demonstrate every day that the God they really worship is the great God of what's in it for me. We all know that, and we recognize it in ourselves, but somehow we can't seem to grasp the fact that this is the deadliest threat to what is human in our world today. We ought to be able to see it as no other human community in the history of man. Air, water, and soil are threatened by death from pollution on a global scale, and that's a direct result of worship of the great God, what's in it for me. What happens to other people or other generations or the human community is unimportant so long as I get mine. Not just whatever I need, but whatever I happen to want. And we could go on. What injustice, or what vice, what violence, or what war or threat of global catastrophe does not root back somewhere in the grinning sneer of people asking, what's in it for me? We are just now beginning to see the deadly reality of all this for human existence in our own times. But nearly 2,800 years ago, Hosea proclaimed these consequences to Israel in an even deadlier way. In rejecting the love of God, he says, you have rejected life itself. In choosing to worship the gross national product, you are worshiping death. The rules of the game are now clear in the 11th chapter of Hosea. Israel has rejected love and chosen death. The consequences are obvious and apparently unavoidable. They will have to go back to Egypt, says the text. Back to that slavery from which love freed them. Assyria must be their king because they have refused to return to me. The sword will rage through their towns, wiping out their children, glutting itself inside their fortresses. But again, this is no game. As few other texts in the Bible, the 11th chapter of Hosea reveals the heartache of God when his people choose death instead of life. Listen to what I would call a lover's soliloquy, God's soliloquy of rejected love in Hosea 11. The translation is somewhat free. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and I called my son out of Egypt. But the more I called to them, the further they went from me. It was I myself that taught them to walk, and when they went boom, I took them in my arms. Yet they have not understood that I was the one looking after them. I guided them in a toddler's harness whose straps were kindness and love. I was like one who lifts an infant close against his cheek. But now look, my people are diseased through their rejection of love. They cry out to all sorts of gods and gimmicks to cure them, but none can cure, really cure. Oh, my people, how can I give you up? How can I watch you become like Sodom and Gomorrah? My heart recoils within me. My very bowels lurch at the thought. That's how deeply God cares. That's how deeply he is in this thing with us. By the way, the next time someone tells you that the Old Testament God is a vindictive God of wrath, suggest that they read the 11th chapter of Hosea. The whole Old Testament is one great story of God's search for people, his relentless will to restore and reconcile and heal. But that turns out to be a deeply painful search, because death is just not the same thing as life. Hatred is not the same thing as love, and self-seeking is not the same thing as justice. When we choose death and hatred and self, there is heartbreak and anguish with God. So deeply is God in this thing with us. So deeply is this world beloved. But the rules of the game are that God must now confront his people with that violence and death which they have chosen. That's the logic of the game. It surely is the logic of our human experiences of love, love offered and love rejected. When you've said yes to someone over and over again, when you have cared for someone at great cost for a long time, and all you have received is rejection and contempt, what is there to do, finally, but turn your back? And we've simplified the rules even more than that. You hit me and I'll hit you. I may even hit you first if I suspect you're out to hit me. If I don't get mine, you'll take it from me. Those are the rules of the human game, apparently. That's how we worship the great God, what's in it for me, and that way lies death for the human community. But God says, King's X, in Hosea 11, listen, I will not give rein to my fierce anger. I will not destroy Ephraim again, for I am God and not man. I am the Holy One in your midst. I will not come to destroy. God claims the royal right to love those who reject his love. King's X, the rules by which we play, the rules of vengeance and retribution, do not bind God, for he is God and not man, and his holiness burns nowhere brighter than in his invincible will to love even those who reject love. And of course, that kind of love is costly. Christians see that kind of love made flesh in Jesus Christ. From his cross, he cries out for the people who nail him to it and mock him upon it. Father, forgive them. King's X. King's cross. I am the Holy One in your midst. I will not come to destroy. The rules of the game are that love like that is always a loser. That way lies death at the hands of those who worship the great God, what's in it for me? But the gospel of God, the good news of Easter, says King's X. In God's royal purpose for this world, love like that never loses. It alone has life and gives life in a cross-shaped world. The future belongs to the love of God in Christ, and even now the tide of that future is sweeping through this world, however invisible it may seem to the eyes of power, lust, and death. And the marvel is that even we who have rejected love are free to share in that future of God right here and now. We can say, King's X, I no longer have to hate people who hate me, or despise people who despise me, or return evil for evil. I no longer have to worship the great God, what's in it for me, the God of death. King's X, King's cross, breaks that power. Those deadly old rules no longer apply. The New Testament makes it clear that saying King's X like that is still a very costly affair. That X is cross-shaped, and there's no doubt about that. And it is a matter of taking up one's cross daily. But it all depends on where you think the victory is, where you think life is, whether you want to worship death or not. Faith says victory lies with the one who dared to love even those who reject love, who sets us free to love like that. Love one another, he said, as I have loved you. Old Samuel Rutherford once said these words about those little X's, those little crosses that Christians carry. He that will take that crabbit tree and carry it cannily will yet find it to be such a burden as wings are to a bird or sails to a boat. And that's where the future of this old world lies in the purpose of God, King's X.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Dr. James A. Wharton. For a free transcript of his sermon, King's X, you can visit us online at dayone.org. Friends, I'm still thinking about how Tom noted what hits so well about this sermon of Wharton's from 1972. It's a hopeful, inspiring call to conversion. It's a call for us to turn away from the old gods and to turn toward the God who can't let us go. I know I need sermons that help me do that turn, and I wonder if you do too. At Day One, we uplift sermons that comfort, challenge, and expand our view of God's presence in the world. That's what we strive to bring you every week, preaching that connects your faith to real life. But we can't do it without your support. Your generous contributions make it all possible. Thank you for helping us continue this vital ministry. Visit us online at dayone.org/donate to make a financial donation, or mail your gift to Day One, 4062 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite A629, Atlanta, Georgia, 30319. Next week on Day One, we're heading outdoors, at least metaphorically, with a joyful and thought-provoking sermon from Reverend Dr. Elizabeth E.B. Arnold entitled, Go Outside and Play. Eby is the kind of convicted preacher who brings such passion and lightness, but also serious theological heft to every sermon. A teacher, preacher, and biblical scholar with a gift for humor and insight, Eby helps us hear a familiar story with fresh ears. Don't miss it. That's next week on Day One. Wow, Tom, what a sermon.
Well, it might not seem like it, but this sermon was really a call to conversion. It was a call to turn away from the old gods, the god of what's in it for me, the god of national production, the god who deals in lies and death, to turn away from that god and to turn toward the god that Hosea talks about, the God who can't let Israel go, who is a loving and kind God. And back in Calvin's day, the old founder of what we call Presbyterianism today, and back in Calvin's day, the founder of what we call Presbyterianism today, and Jim Horton is a Presbyterian, they read the Ten Commandments in every worship service, but they read them after the forgiveness of sins, the assurance of pardon.
They read all Ten Commandments? I did not know that.
And when you read them after you're forgiven, it's not, here are things that you shouldn't do, but here are things that you are now free to do. You don't have to have any other gods before you. You don't have to covet what is your neighbor's. You are free to take care of your mother and father and honor them all the days of your life because of the nature of the freeing, liberating God. And he's got that in this sermon when he says, right here and now, I no longer have to hate people who hate me or despise people who despise me. I no longer have to worship the great God of what's in it for me. Those old rules don't apply to me anymore. He's been liberated into a new way of living, a new way of life.
So historically, do you think it's likely that, like, he, especially coming with the Bardian experience in Switzerland, like, I mean, about as one could argue, very Calvinistic.
Indeed. And in fact, the Ten Commandments can be used in at least two ways. One is they remind us of the sins that we commit. And Lutherans read them also in worship, but before the prayer of confession. So you would hear these Ten Commandments and say, oops, I did that, oops, I did that, and then pray the prayer of confession. And the Calvinists read it after the assurance of pardon. Here's how you're free to live.
Wow.
Both are valuable.
Yeah, I love that. I was remembering, and Tom, I'm going to throw back at you really lovely quotes of yours that I've loved over the years. And here's one. Prophetic preaching often doesn't thunder. It weeps. It laments the brokenness, even as it refuses to give up on people.
Yeah.
Which is opposite what we usually think about prophet. Like, well, prophet's going to wag his finger at us and say, here's what you did wrong.
Yeah.
But no.
No, the prophet lays out God's vision for what creation and humanity should be, and then points out the way that humanity is and weeps about the difference.
I will say the moment that made me weep the most in the sermon, like and it's from the text, is, you know, when Wharton says, Israel has rejected, the people of God have rejected love and they've chosen death. The consequences are obvious and apparently unavoidable. They will have to go back to Egypt, Hosea's text says, back to that slavery from which love freed them. It's such a heart sinker, maybe especially from an American perspective, because we always like to progress and get better and bigger all the time, always be moving forward, even if it's a little bit slow. Oh, backwards. What?
Yeah.
No.
Well, it is backwards. It's also the starkness of the choice. Is it going to be the old life, or is it going to be the God of the new and life of salvation and hope? And God is pictured in a parental way here, calling to the children, come home, come home. But they keep going back themselves. That's the choice they make. And as a parent, we know about this with our children.
Yep.
And finally, like every loving parent, God says, I can't let them go. I will not treat them with anger.
Yeah. I kept thinking about this. Also, there's this book, it's called Let Them, and I'm not going to remember the author right now, but it's basically about, like, you know, knowing what's your work to do and knowing what's other people's work to do. And a lot of times you need to say, let them, like, and then to let yourself be yourself kind of thing. And I love how God is letting people be themselves and suffer the consequences of their actions. But ultimately, God is saying, no, I can't and I won't really let you go.
That same theme is picked up by Marilynne Robinson, the great novelist, who has just published a book called Reading Genesis, in which she does a close reading of the book of Genesis. And in Genesis, it's utterly frank about the terrible things that people do. And some of those stories are just awful stories of misbehavior and sinfulness. And Marilynne Robinson insists all the way through, this is God's respect for the creature. God will not control like some ancient angry deity. God wants a relationship, and that involves freedom.
I love also how he brings up that the next time somebody tells you that the Old Testament God is a vindictive God of wrath, suggest that they read that 11th chapter of Hosea. Do you think he's right that, like, this helps just break a sort of characterization of the Old Testament that often isn't?
Yeah, in fact, that was the theme of Jim Wharton's whole teaching career in the Old Testament world. Uh-huh. If he would wear a T-shirt that would say God is love even in the Old Testament. I think, once again, this goes back to his old teacher in Switzerland, Karl Barth, who insisted on the unity of the scriptural canon, that you did not change horses or gods when you went from one testament to the other. And there are so many Christians who take the opposite view that, you know, some pastors never preach from the Old Testament because the New Testament has the gospel and they don't want to preach the law. But as we see in this sermon and in Hosea, it's gospel all the way through.
Thinking about the time context of this sermon and that it's 1972, how surprising or not is it that he says, you know, we ought to be able to see it as no other human community in the history of people. Air, water, and soil are threatened by death from pollution on a global scale. I mean, it's only been 10 years or so since Silent Spring, or maybe it's been a little longer than that. But I mean, this conversation, bringing that environmental awareness into a sermon in 1972, how sort of unusual was that?
That would have been quite unusual. In the 70s, we were not as environmentally aware as we are today, even though we're not aware enough today, but it was not the big issue that you talked about. You tended to, if you were to talk about world issues, moral issues, it would have been race, war, with Vietnam especially, that would have been very much on our mind. Watergate soon. But the environment would be down, way down on the list, and now it's moved way up on the list.
Any other real gems that you want to make sure we hear in what this sermon gives us today?
Well, he's got a very nice preacher's technique here. He starts off the sermon by talking about a childhood game he used to play where the player of the game would be able to say, King's X.
Yep.
And it would negate all the rules of the game. And he gets that around at the end of the sermon to say that the real king, God the king, the X is the cross. And it's a very costly affair. And it's a matter of taking up one's cross daily. But it all depends on where you think the victory is, where you think life is, whether you want to worship death or not. Constantly this choice between the idolatrous God and the living God. The living God can be seen most clearly in the cross.
Yes. He pulls no punches about the vulnerability of Jesus on the cross, and then by extension, then just the vulnerability of faith itself. And he really, he just pushes against any temptation to domesticate crucifixion or to, you know, hold back about like what that means, it seems.
That's right. And when we are in control, we give way to the impulses of revenge and anger and a punitive retaliation. The prophet Hosea just breathes of a God who is calling us to the opposite of that.
Tom, thank you so much for being with us for this Day One Classics sermon, and can't wait for the next time you'll join us to do so.
Thank you, Katie.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 80 years, proclaiming God's hope to a hurting and divided world. 80 years is a whole lot of Sundays, and we're grateful to God for every one. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media. You can visit us anytime at dayone.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Kime. May the grace of God be with you on day one and every day yet to come.